Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Gavin Monnery.
Monnery, that's it, yeah.
Monnery, yeah, excellent. We're in London Crewe in well, London really, isn't it, near Earls Court?
Absolutely, yeah, we're 5 minutes away from Earls Court.
Yeah, well, I came by bus, actually. I got off at Hammersmith, and it's about a 25-minute walk from Hammersmith. So that was my first mistake. So I got here a wee bit late. Never mind. Apologise for that.
No, not a problem.
What I want to do is talk a wee bit about London Crewe, really. What you do, what it's all about, where everything comes from, etc.
For sure. Okay. Ask away.
So what is London Crewe?
Well, I mean, to be fair, we're a winery the same as any other winery, I suppose. The main difference is that we work with grapes from across Europe and including the UK sometimes. So we work with various different growers in the countries, and we harvest the grapes. We hand harvest everything. We refrigerate them and we ship them to London, and then all of the processing is done here.
Does that mean that the wine's coming in, what's the objective of that? Why do it here as opposed to in Portugal or France or Spain?
Well, partly because all of the regulations in these places would make it difficult to work with grapes from outside their respective regions. So, you know, I could work in Burgundy, but I would be working with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. I mean, you know, two pretty good varieties to get stuck with. But, you know, if you want to ship up some Syrah from the Languedoc, then, you know, it's really difficult. So, and of course, the other one was that, you know, we wanted to start a winery where the people are. You know, there's 8 million people in London, and we were hoping that if we put a winery on their doorstep, that they'd come down and visit and, you know, learn a little bit about wine. But also we're trying to, I suppose, demystify it a little bit. A lot of the time when you visit a winery, you get shown a fairly sterile cellar door type arrangement, but we let people come right back into the production area, and we show them the equipment and explain a little bit about how we make things.
Oh, okay. So I wasn't quite sure whether it was more touristy or whether that was the process, because you get some people who set up like craft brewing, and what they do is they allow people to come in and make their own beers. But, and I was looking on your website and it sort of said, you know, you've got a product called Become a Winemaker for the Day.
We do, yeah. That's kind of more of a that's more of a day out as an event type thing. You know, we get people in and we deconstruct some wines. We show them tannin and acid in isolation, and then we, you know, benchmark each person's palate against it. So they get to try. You know, I can try and explain the sensations you feel when you try tannin, but, you know, it's not as good as actually just giving them, you know, something that's particularly tannic. So we do that, and they do a little bit of blending and stuff like that, but they're not actually making the wines here. I mean, the wines take, you know, a year to make pretty much, so it's a little bit difficult. And I suppose from the outset, we were absolutely aiming to make top quality wines. It was never about, you know, being a bit gimmicky or anything like that. But, you know, I can see why people are a bit cynical sometimes when they come in. But, yeah, no, absolutely, we're about making quality wines 100%.
Okay, so there was a company in California called Crush, I think, that used to do that.
Crush Pad, yeah, they're the ones.
Yeah, do they still work? They went out of business, didn't they?
Yeah, Crush Pad have gone out of business. A few of those models have gone out of business. It gets a bit difficult because, you know, taste is subjective. And when you're trying to work with 300 different people, all with similar grapes, and everyone wants a slightly different product, it would become impossible. So, So we do all of the sourcing and we do all of the wine making, and then, you know, we sell the wines like any other winery would. You know, we go out and hit the bricks and talk to restaurants and try and sell it.
All right. So, I noticed on your website you're selling it to a number of restaurants. Not huge amounts. You sell direct as opposed to through a wholesaler or like that?
Yeah, we sell direct. We're starting to work with Robeson Wines now, a wholesaler.
They're part owner, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Full owner or part owner?
No, Cliff Robeson's a 50% shareholder. Will Tomlinson is the other investor. But we're going to sell it through Robeson Wines. At the moment, we're listed at about 35 restaurants across London, and that's actually, it's about 70% of our turnover is directly to restaurants, only 30% to the consumer. And, you know, hopefully we're in the process of building up a mailing list in a wine club. I'd like to kind of flip that around. I'd like to sell 70% direct to consumer. and then just keep a little bit for our sort of existing trade customers.
Yeah. I suppose the nice thing about consumers is A, they pay when you buy it rather than 6 to 7 years later.
Yeah, no one wants 90-day terms.
and you probably get to pay full retail prices.
Yeah, our retail margin's not particularly high compared to a lot of wine businesses, and our trade margin's even narrower again. So yeah, obviously, you know, I think these days though, when you've got a wine club, everyone expects certain, you know, everyone wants case discounts and specials and stuff like that. So actually, what I've seen is, and especially with the transparency that things like Wine Searcher have brought about, is that actually educated wine consumers are pretty much paying trade price for most of the wines that they're buying these days anyway. Yeah, pretty close to it. If they're buying case quantities and up, then definitely, yeah.
Let's talk a wee bit about sourcing your grapes. So you said you got where do you get them from?
We work with a few different growers, actually. We get a couple of varieties from France, one from Italy, two from Spain. We've worked with grapes from the UK before. So finding grapes is the hardest part of what we do, yeah.
You normally think people want to sell it. Yeah, there's a lot of growers who are looking to sell their stuff.
There are. There's a lot of growers who want to sell grapes, but there's not that many growers that, you know, grow the sort of quality grapes that we want. So that's the problem. I mean, there's tons of grapes out there that you can buy any day of the week, but unfortunately, finding people who really, you know, who care about their site and who would, you know, are happy to control their yields and things like this, you know, that's difficult.
Okay. So what happens? Some models where you have a winery buying grapes, they don't necessarily own the site, they've got a grower to do it, but they might specify the yields, they'll specify the spraying methodology, they'll specify all sorts of things about that site. They may even specify which clones to be planted in the first place sometimes, depending on where you go. You guys obviously haven't been going long enough to get that.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we do have a yield, and we also have different, we have other parameters. You know, I have, you know, it's got to be within a certain pH level. It's got to have a certain amount of acidity. You know, most of our growers, all but one actually, are organic anyway. So, you know, they are spraying, but they don't have, you know, the complex spray programs of a larger commercial winery, perhaps. And I visit two or three times during the year as well. So I always go out just before Veraison to check the health of the crop and to check the yield. And then I always go out for the harvest itself and supervise the actual picking of the harvest.
You said it was all hand-picked. I imagine if you're transporting grapes, if you do a machine harvest where the grapes are sort of ripped off the stems, that would lead to a lot of oxidation. So hand-picking is the only way you could really do that.
I mean, I've seen, in Australia, it's common to ship machine harvested fruit quite long distances.
Western Australia,
I'm from. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I've heard of, you know, I've heard of people taking Syrah from the Hunter Valley and fermenting it in South Australia. You know, so it's not uncommon. But the problem that I have with machine harvesting is, like you said, you know, you're juicing it up immediately, and when you've got all of that juice available, you need to add a lot of sulfur dioxide to combat oxidation and to stop fermentation starting. So, you know, with hand harvesting, A, we get to control, you know, what goes in the bins straight away. So if there's anything that's underripe or overripe or mouldy or whatnot, we discard it in the vineyard. And the other thing is that we don't use any sulfur dioxide at all until the grapes are crushed here in the winery. So through the journey, all we use is temperature. So we chill them.
Getting nice and cold.
Exactly, yeah, we chill everything down to 5 degrees. Fermentation wouldn't start until after we'd crushed all of the grapes and stuff like that.
You'll always get a little bit of juice at the bottom anyway.
Yeah, sometimes the cases that we've got are designed to keep that separate, actually. So any of that sort of, any of those damaged berries that do, you know, when you liberate a little bit of juice, you know, that tiny little bit of free run is, you know, like you say, it's horribly oxidized and not very nice. So that gets discarded. So the cases that we've got and the sorting table that we've got here make sure that juice doesn't go through.
Oh, okay. So it's any whole bunches of grapes.
Absolutely. Yeah. We do another hand sort here in the winery. So it's literally only perfect bunches that go through.
What sort of time does it take to get the grapes?
Grapes, it takes us 36 hours to get them to the door here
from
anywhere that we've worked. Yeah, I mean, we do have limits. You know, I can't, we can take, you know, grapes from, you know, probably almost all of France, you know, good part of Germany, maybe Austria, Slovenia sometimes I've been looking out. But then when you go down to Italy, we could probably go down to Tuscany, but no further. And Spain, you know, we work in Calatayud, which is 3 hours north of Madrid. So we could probably get down to sort of, you know, central Spain and maybe northern Portugal, but that's it. Any further than that, and it takes an extra day.
And what's the problem if the grapes are cold? Is there a certain level of time that people know that you can only keep whole grapes for?
Not really. No one's really tested it. I've heard there are some urban wineries in the US that ship their grapes from California to New York by train, and that takes 5 days. So really, the 36-hour target is just a number that I made up myself for sort of quality purposes. I don't really want to test the boundaries to see what would happen. You know, we're aiming at making top quality wine. I'm not really interested in pushing the limits and seeing what sort of average wine we can make if we leave the grapes for 10 days or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds interesting. And you mentioned earlier that one of the problems you've got with, say, me bringing grapes up from, well, the classic one is the old Burgundy used to be half North African anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they would always ship finished wine, but, you know, I mean, I think one of the great things for me personally anyway about this project is that I get to work with different varieties from different regions in the same year. So, you know, I am, rather than just being stuck in Burgundy with Pinot and Chardonnay, you know, I can work with, you know, a dozen varieties from all over Europe, which is very, very exciting, you know, from a winemaking perspective.
How do you get around with all the regulations? Because I think technically, if you're bringing grapes into the UK and making wine, it's technically classed as British wine.
It could be. There's a few different classes. We choose to label ours under the European Community Wine category. British wine is mostly only used for fortifieds, cream sherry and stuff like that now. Yeah. But that's essentially where people bring in concentrated grape must. So, you know, grape juice concentrate, and then it's diluted here and then fermented. But again, it's a pretty low-level category, and it's certainly not something that we would do. To be honest, I've put it on the record before, but I think it's a confusing category, the British wine. I think if you want to call it British or English, it should be UK-grown, UK-made.
So what do you call it, though?
A European community wine. There's a couple of categories that we were legally allowed to use. One of them is European community wine, and the other one that we could have put on the bottle was wine obtained in the UK from grapes grown in France or Spain or whatever. So we thought the latter was a little bit of a mouthful. So,
yeah. And does that mean, is that like Vin de France but gone bigger? You know, with Vin de France, they can bring grapes in from anywhere around France and make them.
Exactly. Anywhere from inside the European community. And it could be fresh grapes shipped and made in a specific country, or it could be different wines bought. I mean, you could buy finished wines from various countries and blend them and still call it European community wine. So it's pretty much the lowest category that you can get.
Yeah, because you've got PDOs, PGIs, and then table wines. So your stuff, because of the
exactly, price, yeah. We, the quality, we're coming under table wine. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Table wine. There's no geographical indicator because it's not made in the region.
And it's ironic because all of our wines, except for the Grenache actually, are all single vineyard parcels. There's no blending, there's no adulteration or anything like that.
So you don't even blend. I thought you might blend across.
Not even across varieties, no. Oh, I mean,
so I do a little bit of that with finished wine, and I'll tell you what you can make.
Yeah, I do as well. Nice. I do as well, honestly. I have done that as well. I think it's something that I look at every year. But for me, the only reason to blend wines is to make it better. You know, if the resulting wine is better than the sum of its parts, then great. But also we're quite careful here to make each wine, you know, varietally correct. So I want a Syrah to look like a Syrah. If I add a little bit of Cab Sav in, it doesn't look like Syrah or Cab Sav. It just looks like generic red wine, you know.
Is it all single varietals?
All single varietals, yeah. But I mean, like I said, so far, I mean, sometimes I actually think that Syrah and Barbera could make quite a nice blend. That's something that I've done a few bench blends in the lab before and come up with a few interesting things, you know. But yeah, so far.
Yeah, because that to me is quite an interesting idea. I've blended finished wines from different areas, and you can make some really nice wine.
you can do. I mean, if one particular wine is deficient in some way or something like that, then absolutely blending can help out. I mean, you know, the classic example is always the Bordeaux, you know, some early ripening Merlot into some green Cab Sav makes for a decent drinking wine, you know. But yeah, I think, I don't know, we could do it potentially from a PR angle. You know, we could blend wines from different countries, and I'm sure we could get a story or two, but you know, if it doesn't make the wine better, then really what's the point as far as we're concerned anyway?
All right then, Gavin, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Cool. No worries at all. Thanks.